You're listening to The Write Process, a podcast in which one writer tells the story of completing one work from concept to completion. I'm your host, Charlie Jensen.
Hello, my name is Sana Balagamwala, and I wrote a book called House Number 12, Block Number 3.
Sana Balagamwala grew up in Karachi, Pakistan. She studied English literature at the University of Southern California and has a master's in education from Loyola Marymount University. Her debut novel, House Number 12, Block Number 3, was published by Hidden Shelf Publishing House in 2021 and won the Forward Indies Gold Medal for Multicultural Fiction. It has also been nominated for the Martine Crew Smith Award by the California Independent Booksellers Alliance. She lives in Los Angeles with her family and is currently working toward her Master of Studies in Creative Writing at the University of Cambridge. House Number 12, Block Number 3, narrates the story of a young woman's journey towards confrontation and healing. Nadia, 19, has long struggled with bouts of unresolved illness and trauma as a result of assault she experienced as a child. But unable to share her truth, Nadia keeps her tragic secret to herself. Her family, unable to find a reason for her illness, begins to wonder if she is possessed by a djinn, cursed, or worse, inclined to madness. House number 12, the house she lives in, is the only witness to the crime that has all but devastated her and narrates her story. The novel explores gender roles and the misinformation and social taboos that surround mental illness and sexual violence in many South Asian cultures, and shines a light on both the personal and the political as it chronicles a time period in Pakistani history riddled with political strife.
Writing a novel was something I always thought I would do one day, but I always thought it would be later in life when I was done with all the responsibilities like working, raising our children. I thought I would write a novel one day in the future when I had time. One night, my husband and I were in the kitchen and I said, you know, it would be so cool for me to write a novel one day. And I was in the middle of mashing peas or something really inspiring like that. And when we were feeding our boys, who at that time were 2 and 4. And my husband looked at me and he said, why one day? Why not now? The conversation triggered something in me. And, you know, I thought to myself, yeah, why not now? And so later that night, I signed up for a writing class at UCLA Extension. The class was called Novel One with Deborah Reed. And that's the class that started my writing journey that eventually led to this novel. I moved to Los Angeles for university. And while I was living here, two of my grandparents, my maternal grandfather and my paternal grandfather, passed away. Losing them made me feel this sense of loss of not being able to talk to them, of hearing their stories ever again. So I started talking to uncles and aunts and reading about the time period that they grew up in. As I read and as I researched, some characters started developing in my mind, sort of formed into this work of fiction inspired by historical and other events that took place during the period that my parents and my grandparents lived in, like 1950 to 1980. The first few chapters that I wrote were just things getting out of my system. I wrote things, I tossed them, I rewrote them. It was going to be a very different novel in the beginning. It was going to be a very thick, multi-generational novel. And as I kept writing, a lot of things kind of fell to the side and kind of used the historical facts and dates as pillars and as a structural construct to hold up the story. And I wove in the fictional stories of the characters within that. I'm not a very structured person, but I do really well when I am structured. So I had to really force myself to make time to write. And it wasn't every day, but I would try to write at least 3 times a week. And I would write in the mornings after I dropped my children to school. I was fortunate that I did not have a traditional 8 to 5 p.m. job. So I could make a few hours during the day work. However, I think because there was no one waiting for my work, there was no one paying me for my work, it always dropped right to the bottom of my priority list of things to do, like after cleaning the bathroom and doing the dishes. In fact, anytime I have a deadline, the only thing I really want to do is do dishes or organize closets. And that's just something I need to work around. The minute a deadline comes up, I'm like, oh, which closet can I clean so I don't need to focus on my writing? For me, it's just finding time in the middle of the day to just write. And many times I would leave the house, I would just take my computer, take my notes, and just head to the nearest coffee shop and just turn off my phone and just write for an hour or write for 2 hours. It was not as consistent of a writing schedule that I would have liked, but my goal was I will finish this draft. No matter what, I will finish it. This is the one thing I'm going to do for myself. So if I have to take 6 years to do it, which it did take me 6 years, I will get it done. There was no like time limit that I gave myself, but sometimes I would just be like, if I can just do this before I die, I would feel happy. So I think that kept motivating me that, you know, I just need to get this done. The other thing that motivated me to get moving is I had chatted with my dad one time. He said, what are you doing now that, you know, your kids are getting older? He had asked me what I'm working on. And I said, oh, you know, I'm trying to write a book. He was really excited. He was like, that's really cool. Can I read it? And I said, no, you can read it when it's published. I just really wanted to write and publish before anyone in my family passed away. It turns out that he has only read 2 chapters. He said it's not bad, but he hasn't finished it. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. The class I took with Deborah Reed, it was just a 1 semester class. But what was really fortunate is a few of the students after that joined together and they said, why don't we just have a workshop and we'll just keep working together? And I thought that was a really nice way of keeping writing because we already kind of had gotten to know each other over the course of that 1 semester. So we just ended up meeting at one of the writers' houses and we would just meet once a month. We would all bring in our writing and we would share. And I think we kept ourselves accountable and we kept ourselves motivated. And if it wasn't for that, I probably would have stopped writing. It went on for about, I would say, a year. And after that, we sort of went our separate ways. But we would try to do a few workshops if we could just come together in some way. Maybe even after a year, we would try to come together. And I think just consistently keeping in touch was really helpful in keeping ourselves motivated. And I think that's what helped me keep going. While I was writing, I would rewrite chapters consistently. So one of the difficulties I had in the writing and the editing process was my story grew organically as I wrote it. I never had a storyboard. I would just write a chapter and I wasn't really sure where it would fit, but it was just written. And then I would revise that chapter and polish it up and just keep it to the side. And then I would write another chapter. And so at the end of it, I had maybe 30 chapters and some of them were in chronological order and some of them were just random chapters, but they were all revised. So each of the chapters was revised several times. So after all of them were sort of decent, you know, they had already been read by someone in my workshop or a friend, I sort of juggled them around and I, you know, sorted them into the form of the book. And once that was done, I had to go back and revise it and tie some ends together because they all didn't flow as well. So I think that was the first revision that I did, the first big revision. Each revision probably took a few months. After I had done about 3 revisions of it, I felt really stuck. I wasn't sure what to do with it next. And I wasn't even sure if it was a novel, actually. My writing professor, who had done the initial writing workshop at UCLA Extension, I had reached out to her when I finished my draft and I said, I don't know what to do with this. I think it's done, but I don't know what to do next. And she connected me to someone she knew who did developmental edits. And I reached out to her and I said, this is what I have. And would you be willing to read it for me and give me feedback? Process of the developmental edit, it can take about 1 to 2 months. So I sent her my work and she sent it back in about a month with really detailed comments and notes. And I read through them. She said, if you want to have a conversation or you have any more questions, you can email me back. So I sort of just read through it, but the notes were really self-explanatory. And I had a couple of questions that I asked her. We never sat down and had a meeting or even a phone call. We just kind of did it via email. It was hard to see so much red all over my manuscript. That was kind of took me back to like being a child in school when you get everything wrong. And she had warned me. She said, it looks like a lot, but I'm giving you what you paid for. You know, you want feedback and that's what I'm giving you. So don't be disheartened. And so I tried to keep that in mind. I looked through her notes. I gave myself permission to not have to take all the feedback. It was expensive and I wasn't sure if I should do it, but it was actually really, really helpful because I felt validated by her feedback. She said, this is great. Keep going. And she gave me a lot of very concrete things that I could do to tie some of the loose ends together. One of the things that really was helpful to me was the editor picked up on my main character. And I was always wondering about my main character, and I felt I didn't develop her enough and I didn't develop her properly. And I think it's the feedback that she gave me about what kinds of things to include about her personality and about her habits, and to kind of intersperse them through the novel to make it more coherent. So I think that was really helpful in making the character become more whole rather than one-dimensional. It was just really great to get a new set of eyes who had never seen my work to see it as a whole. For a lot of the time when we're writing, we're so isolated and it's such a insular sort of a process. Sometimes I didn't even know if what I was writing was any good. So it just was so helpful to get someone from the outside to just say, yeah, that has potential. This can go places. And then I took another couple of months to revise the novel. And then finally, I think this was draft 4 or 5. After I felt I had revised it as much as I could, maybe I even over-revised it, I started sending it out to agents. I went in quite blind. I had no idea what to expect from an agent or a press. So I was Googling a lot. I had a couple of books that had been recommended to me. So I read those and I wrote query letters, and then I shared them with friends of mine who were in MFA programs. And I said, can you please read this for me? Does it make sense? Does it sound legit? So that was helpful. My friends from my writing group were helpful in giving me a little feedback. So I wrote the letter and I sent it out to a few agents, and I didn't hear back, and I got one rejection, and I was like, it's okay. We're supposed to get a lot of rejections. Everyone gets rejections. And then I would have a mental list of all the greats in the world who've got rejected so many times. I was like, I'm good. It's okay to be rejected. It means I'm great. So I just kept telling myself that. I hadn't applied for agents for very long, but when I attended a conference, it was a very small writers conference in Manzanita in Oregon. And there were some really great writers there, but it was a really nice, small, intimate conference, which meant that we were able to have conversations with a lot of people. So again, my writing professor was there as well, and she introduced me to my agent. At first, she said, oh, this is Sana, she's written this book. And he was very like stern-faced looking. And he's like, so tell me about your book. And immediately, I did not know what my book was about. So I said something really, really bad and terrible. He was really unimpressed. He was like, that's not the kind of work I represent. And I'm not sure if it can go anywhere. Like, that's kind of what he said. And I was like, yep, I agree. And he said, but why don't you do this? Why don't you just send me your manuscript? I'll see what I can do, you know? And I was like, okay, he's being nice. That's really nice of him. So I sent it to him, my query letter and my manuscript. And I didn't hear from him for a few weeks. And during that, I got another rejection from another agent. And I was like, okay, that's fine. Rejections, yay. I did not expect to hear back from the agent I had met at the conference. And then he wrote back and he was like, I love it. It's great. I would like to sign you on. And I was very shocked. I was really shocked, but I was very excited. And obviously I said, yes, please sign me on. I was so thrilled that someone liked my book. But I was just never sure. I was not sure how to get the right agent, who was the right agent for me. So I think that is something that maybe comes with experience, because as a first-time writer, you're just so happy. If anyone says yes to you, you're just like, great, please take everything. I'll sign my children also if you want. Please take it. It's really overwhelming. Everything is very overwhelming because writing is something writers are used to. We're okay with it. You know, we know how to do it, but it's getting ourselves out there into the world and interacting with agents and interacting at conferences. That was really very hard for me. And it really pushed me outside my comfort zone. So I had an agent. I did not do any editing with my agent. He had a few thoughts on the novel, but what he suggested, he said, you've already had a developmental edit. Let's try to sell it first and see what happens before I give you any more edits. So we didn't edit it together ourselves. We just kind of sent it out as is. But then it got really hard because we sent my work out to many publishers and I got rejected by so many of them. I have about 13 letters that I received that my agent sent to me, which I've kept. Maybe there were many more that he didn't send to me. Just maybe he felt bad for me. They were hard to read. Some of them were really nice rejections. Some of them were kind of rude rejections, but they were all rejections. After that, I was very close to kind of taking my manuscript back and just telling my agent, I'm just going to rewrite it because this is not going anywhere. And he said, just, okay, that's fine. If that's what you want to do, let's just wait. Let's wait a couple of months. Let's see what happens. And this was also during COVID. So things were not as they had been in the past. The publishing industry was changing. And my agent kept telling me that things are not as easy as they used to be. So you have to be patient. So I said, okay, let's wait maybe 2 months. And then after 2 months, I was ready to just take my manuscript back and then completely rewrite it. But during those 2 months, my agent connected me with a very small press. It was an independent press out of Idaho. They're a very new press, and they wanted to sign me on. At that time, I was really excited that there was one press that was willing to read my work and liked it. So I said, yeah, let's do it. So we signed, and I was really excited. And then the process with the press started, the editing and the rewriting. There was a lot of things I learned along the way, and a lot of amazing people who helped me out. I was on a very steep learning curve. A lot of the times I felt like what I just learned, I should have known a year ago. And what I was applying for today, I should have applied for a year ago. So it was just really steep, fast-paced learning curve. And I just felt I was always running to catch up. The editing process with my press was actually not as difficult as I thought, but it was very scary. I really appreciated that my editor did not make very big changes in my story. And that allowed me to keep true to myself and true to my story. So I really appreciated that. The thing that was very scary to me was I was writing about something I knew. I was writing about a young girl growing up in Pakistan, but I was always so worried that I was not being authentic enough. I was not being true to the subject matter. So I requested the editing department. I asked if they would get a sensitivity reader for me, and they were really great. They agreed. And so we found a sensitivity reader, and she kind of went through my work and she gave me a little bit of feedback. After I had done incorporating that, I felt like, okay, I feel like I'm being a little bit more true to my subject. So I think that was the scariest thing for me. I just kept feeling like an imposter. Here I am writing a story about someone and it's not right. It's not true. And that just kept tripping me up. It was really, really difficult to get over that. And that was one layer of edit that we did. The other layer of edit that we did was the historical facts, because the story is fiction, but it's anchored by actual events in history, in Pakistani history. I had read a lot of history books and a lot of news articles, and to get my dates and my timeline correct, I think the day before my draft was due to my editor, I realized that there was one chapter I had written on a date which was completely wrong. And I panicked and I had to rewrite the chapter, re-put it in the timeline. It was really stressful. Yeah, those kinds of like weird things in the editing process were, I just felt like this will never get done, because every time I read it, I find something wrong. Every time I read it, something is missing. And my editor was so amazing. She was just calm. If I needed more time, she would give it to me. I thought she would just be like, Sana, we're dropping you. You are just too much trouble. But she wasn't. She was just amazing and relaxed. And she's like, we got this and let's work together. It was just a really, really great editing experience because of how awesome my editor was. What I learned along the way is in small presses, there's usually just one editor who handles the editing process. And there's not always a separate copy editor, line editor, and development editor. So my editor was doing everything. And that's why there was also a lot of burden on me. I think that's what made it very stressful. Every time I read it, I found a mistake. And I knew that if I didn't fix it, it would probably go into publishing that way. Both my editor and I had to be extra, extra vigilant to pick up on any errors ourselves. And I think that's one of the challenges with working with a small press, that there's not as many resources. But on the flip side, the small presses are the ones who pick up these different stories that the mainstream publishers may not want to publish. Definitely, there's a pro and con to working with a small press. The cover also created a lot of panic for me, just because I was just looking for reasons to panic, I think. This was like my child. So, you know, the outfit on your newborn baby matters a lot. So the cover on the book was really important to me. There was a couple of artists at the press, and I spoke to one of the artists, and she did this drawing. She did actually an oil painting of an old house. And I gave her a little bit of feedback and I thought we were going to go with it. And then suddenly they changed it up. They said, we're going to do a graphic design. The novel is told from the point of view of an old house in the city of Karachi in Pakistan. The editing team, they asked me for inspirational pictures of the house, and the cover that they ended up working on is actually a rendition of the flooring in one of the old houses in Karachi. It's actually my husband's grandmother's house, and I loved the flooring and I took a photo of it. It's more than 100 years old, and that was one of the photos I sent to them, and I just loved it. I thought it had such a wonderful connection to history and to my culture and to my city and to the city that the book is based in, and also to the characters in the novel, because the flooring was special in some way to one of the characters. So I think they did such a wonderful job in bringing all those things together and creating a cover that resonated with me and was meaningful to the book. The book came out in 2021 and we were still in COVID. So there was still not very many actual live events in person happening. So I did a couple of events that were on Zoom. Those were really great. I did a few radio shows and those were really great too. And it was just a very surreal experience, just that I'm talking about a book that I wrote and it's already out. Because of COVID, I hadn't really gone into a bookstore and seen it. And one afternoon, I was walking into a local bookstore and I looked into the window, and there on a little stand where it said local authors was my book. And I could not believe it. I don't even know what I did. I think I texted like my mom and my husband and my friends. I was like, my book is in a bookstore. And they're like, yeah, but it would be, right? And it was so surreal and so amazing. And I'm so appreciative to independent bookstores that amplify local writers. Because one of the things also with working with a small press is their marketing teams are very small and very limited. So the authors themselves have to take on a lot of the marketing and the promoting. And as a new author, that's very difficult to do, because you don't usually have the contacts and you don't know the world as well, the publishing and the marketing world. But it was just really surreal to see my book in a store. My advice to writers would be, don't wait for the right time. Just start writing, because there is no right time. Life will always be busy. You will always have a million things to do. There will never be a time in your life where everything will be wrapped up. Well, you would have made enough money. Your children would be grown up. You know, there's always things happening. So make the time, even if it's just an hour a week, make the time for yourself and be true to your story, be true to yourself and honor your story. I felt many times I second-guessed myself. I second-guessed the story I wanted to tell. I second-guessed my ability to write. And I think creative people often do that. And I think to have that critical eye is really important, except that it gets in the way of you actually being creative. So just push that negativity away and just give yourself permission to write. Even if you think it's crap, that's okay. Just give yourself permission to keep going. Try to find a way to keep yourself accountable. So that could be signing up for a class, which was really helpful for me. Joining a workshop, which was also really helpful to me. Or having your dad check in on you and say, I need you to step it up and I need you to finish your book. Sometimes my kids, I felt like they would ask me, so did you write today? And, you know, so just these little ways of people holding me accountable, because I did not hold myself accountable a lot. So just finding a way to keep yourself accountable, because let's face it, when you're not getting paid for writing, it will make itself to the bottom of your list, but you owe it to yourself to get your work out there and to do something for yourself.
And now a reading from House Number 12, Block Number 3.
Chapter 1, Karachi, Pakistan, December 1981. The sound of the doorbell stirs those who slumber, but Zainab is already awake. She switches on the hallway light and hurries to the foyer, glancing for a moment at the walnut long-case clock that stands in the corner. The steel pendulum sways with resolve and the minute hand staggers to 12. It is 5 a.m., too early for a guest to call, too early even for the vegetable seller who will come by at sunrise, advertising bitter gourd so persistently that she'll buy some just to appease him. It is 5 a.m. Revelers are stumbling home from a night out. The pious are returning from early morning prayers at the mosque. And those fortunate enough to be asleep are dreaming of those unspoken and unspeakable matters of the heart that confront us only in the night. Zainab knows who is at the door, but she peeks through the peephole just to make sure. There has been an upswing in robberies of late. She unbolts the worn-out brass lock, and with a clang, my door creaks open. It is our gatekeeper. He adjusts his disheveled turban and greets Zainab with heavy eyelids. Behind him stands Appa, her frail form barely visible in the dim light of the overhanging pendant. "Thank you for coming," Zainab says. Her voice is hoarse, her face a wrung-out rag. Appa steps past the jasmine topiaries into the foyer. Her silver hair is covered with a black muslin scarf. Her feet are wrapped in brown sandals that crisscross her toes like bandages. She has come to see Nadia. Nadia, who doesn't remember what day it is and who doesn't seem to care. Nadia, who scribbles in notebooks and cries when everyone is asleep. Nadia, who sometimes forgets that her father has just passed away. We are still in mourning. "I'm so sorry to bother you at this hour," Zainab continues. "She wouldn't stop crying. I didn't know what to do." Zainab smooths her chemise and tucks some stray wisps of hair behind her ear. Grays streak her bun, revealing months of forgotten hair appointments. A cool morning breeze wafts in through the open front door, bringing with it the scent of jasmine, as if to remind us that still, there is hope. "It's no bother," Appa says kindly. "Is she like she was the last time?" Zainab nods and draws her gray scalloped shawl tight around her shoulders. A plain maxi flows out from under the shawl, the muted, unfussy attire of a woman mourning her husband. She shuts the door behind her and leads her guests upward towards the bedrooms. In the foyer and hallway, the curtains hang heavy, embroidered with brocade and sorrow. Melancholy has settled comfortably on the Persian carpets that languish across the floor. "She hasn't come out of her room for 3 days," Zainab says. "Typical for her, so I just let her be. We've been taking her food and cajoling her into eating a little. When I woke up for Fajr prayer, she was crying incessantly and trembling like a child possessed. I think the jinn is back. I didn't know what to do, so I called you." She pauses for a moment and sighs. "Appa, it is too much for me." The dim light from the sconces illuminates the gallery of picture frames on the wall, relics from happier times. There's a photograph from long ago, but I remember the day well, Eid morning. Nadia is sitting on her father's lap in a yellow dress of crinkled chiffon, her hair neatly brushed and fashioned into two braids, her smile missing the front two teeth. Haji Rehmat is laughing. The grooves that creased his brow in middle age are not yet visible. "Did you give her any anxiety medication?" Appa asks. "Half a pill to calm her nerves," Zainab says. "She's already on so many prescriptions. I don't want to give her any more." "Perhaps the doctor should increase the dosage," Appa wonders. "Your husband's death aggravated her condition. She may need a little more than before." A low sob escapes Zainab's throat. "The medication he prescribed is for mentally ill patients," she whispers, as though worried that someone will hear her. "My daughter is not mentally ill." Appa glances at Zainab sympathetically and gives her a hand a squeeze. "Did the nurse come as yet?" "No, not yet. She will be here at 8 a.m. The door to the bedroom is slightly ajar. Zainab knocks softly and pushes it open. The curtains are drawn and the room is dark except for the yellow glow of the night lamp that illuminates the bed in a fuzzy bubble of light. Nadia is sitting up in her bed, her back against the low wooden headboard, her head buried in her lap. Her hair is uncombed and matted. Even though it is not cold, she shivers under a thick wooden blanket that Zainab has draped around her. At intervals, she exhales, hollow, empty gasps. Appa goes to her. "She has seen this before. We have all seen this before." "Salam, beta," she says. Nadia digs her thumbnail into her cuticles and picks at the raw skin. A tremor convulses through her body. Appa sits down next to her and takes her hand, squeezing it tightly to stop it from trembling. The elderly woman retrieves an assortment of objects from her bed and lays them on the bedside table. A packet of herbs, a 2-inch rectangular strip of paper, a black square cloth, and some string. On the strip of paper, she transcribes a prayer for wellness in precise Arabic script. She folds it into a square, 1/2 inch by 1/2 inch. She wraps the paper with a cloth and secures it with string, as though wrapping a miniature gift. She gives the amulet to the young girl, who is still trembling. "Put it under your pillow," she says. Nadia glances up. She has her mother's eyes, green with glints of gray. When Nadia was born and opened her eyes to the world for the first time, the nurses had marveled. Among a sea of babies born with dark eyes, her eyes were one in 1,000. She's won the genetic lottery, the nurses had remarked. Prayers were said, and two goats had been sacrificed to protect her from evil eye, Nazar. Now Nadia's eyes are vacant, and her hair is thinning. Clumps lay on her pillow as though someone comes and pulls it out in the night while she sleeps. I don't want to see him, Nadia says softly. She has run out of tears, but sorrow has not had its fill. There are dark caverns beneath her eyes, and her cheeks are sunken like caves. I cannot bear to see her like this. A 20-year-old needs to be vibrant and delirious at the promise of life. She should not be like this. Not like an old spinster, broken and bearing the burdens of the world. There is no one here, now, Zainab says to her daughter. It's just me and Appa. You had a nightmare again. Zainab withdraws from the room and returns with a mug of warm water. Appa draws a packet of herbs into it and stirs vigorously. Some particles dissolve, the big bits and leaves dance about on the surface. Here, take a sip, she says. Nadia drinks. Zainab turns on the wall sconce. The yellow gleam divulges the disarray in Nadia's room. It has been a few weeks since it has been cleaned. She won't let anyone do it since her father has passed away. The desk in the corner by the window is stacked with books and school coursework, overdue, forgotten. Behind the books, slightly visible, are scribbles on the wall. When she is alone, Nadia makes notes in notebooks and sometimes on the walls. The light reveals the worry lines that dart across the young girl's forehead. She winces in discomfort as though it will betray her secrets and covers her face with the blanket. It's too much for me, she says, that light. Zainab flicks the switch off and again we are left in the dark. Appa talks to Nadia and reads out prayers. An hour passes and I see the angst that simmers in the young girl's eyes begin to subside. Perhaps it is prayer that soothes her. Perhaps it is Appa's presence. Nadia closes her eyes and drifts into sleep. Zainab and Appa talk in hushed voices while she sleeps. They discuss the possibility of the jinn possessing her body. Why else would she be this way, Zainab wonders. Why else would she waver between sanity and madness, break into anxious fits of fear and tears with no reason, refuse to leave her room or meet with anyone? I think it too, sometimes, that a jinn has taken over the girl. But I know things that Zainab doesn't, and her ignorance is a burden I must bear. Daylight dissipates the early morning darkness, and the streets begin to come back to life. Neighbors out for a brisk morning walk to ward off cardiovascular disease. Chowkidars perched outside gates on rattan stools drinking their morning tea, and Mrs. Khalid next door buying okra. They all pretend to go about their day and not to notice, but they see Appa leaving. They've seen her come and go before, and they know that Appa visits us at house number 12 on block number 3 because Nadia has gone mad.
The Right Process is hosted and curated by me, Charlie Jensen. This season was produced by Jamie Moss. The Writers Program offers courses, certificates, and services that help writers achieve their writing goals one page at a time. For more information, visit writers.uclaextension.edu.